Hello, and welcome to Building Sustainability Podcast. I'm your host, Geoffrey Hart, aka Geoffrey the Natural Builder. Building Sustainability consists of conversations with designers, builders, makers, dreamers, and doers, exploring the wide world of sustainability in the built environment by talking to wonderful people who are doing excellent things. Hello, welcome to episode 46. This week, we are talking to Flora from Plants and Colour. If this is your first episode, then welcome. Please do subscribe and check out the other crafty episodes. You might like Kaz Ingle talking about weaving willow coffins, Barn the Spoon talking about spoons, and Kiko Denza just talking about sort of craft mentality in general. It's a quick intro today because, I just wanted to cram in as much of this conversation with Flora as possible. Just before the episode, I want to say Patreon, thank you so much to the new subscribers in the last couple of weeks. We've got Sophie Bates Architects, checked out their website, really great. We've got Henrietta Dale, Edward Dale Harris, and the mighty Tom Ingle. Thank you all so much for subscribing. I hope you're enjoying the bonus content. And three of those people have gone for the £5 option, meaning they will soon be receiving hand-carved wooden spoon for eating your breakfast with. Those spoons will be the first that I make when I get to my new home in Exmoor National Park. So that's exciting. Thank you for being patient. I'm a little bit all over the place at the moment, trying to get everything organised and sorted and finished and design a house and say goodbye to some people. Anyway, enough excuses. What good news is, I took some of my stuff down to Exmoor the other day, and where I'm going to be living while I build myself a house is surrounded by birch and cherry trees, which are some of my favourites to carve. So look forward to those. So speaking of moving, this episode is the last one that I will record in my wonderful little narrowboat barefoot. She's been my home for 6 years, and yeah, I'm pretty sad to be leaving her. She's been a really great place to live. I've lived in quite a few different places on many canals and rivers. Spent some time bobbing around on the Thames, feeling very, very small. So yes, I am sad. It feels very good to be sort of part of her story, the barefoot story, and in sort of repair and keeping her going. And she's going to be just a really great home for her new keeper, Martha. I'm really pleased. Martha's super lovely. And yeah, everything, it feels like everything's come together nicely there. What else do I need to tell you about? I wanted to say thank you so much to Flo Hamer. She was the star of our most popular episode, episode number 10 on building a tiny house. She is a super talented craftsperson and maker, and she has done a bite-sized episode, the one just before this, all about women in the workshop. It's a really good one. As part of that, she made a list of badass women who work in workshops, and I added a few as well. And yeah, obviously, as soon as I put out that list, I thought of 10 more. So apologies if you were missed off the list, but I mean, it's just fantastic that there's so many to choose from, isn't there? Okay, well, I managed to waffle on for quite a long time, didn't I? Without further ado, here is the wonderful Flora to tell you all about her work. I'm back at the end very briefly. Enjoy the episode.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Well, I have to try and find a way of describing what I do.
Yeah, I find it. So, what do I do? I don't know. I'm always resistant to labeling myself because it always feels like I don't want to box myself into a job title. But I guess I see myself as a craftsperson and an educator, but I feel very lonely in terms of being a craftsperson. I feel like there's, I don't know, I don't quite feel like I deserve that title, but so I find it easy to just talk about specifically what I do in within the niche. So I make inks, dyes, and paints and artist materials, art materials from plants. And my work is in working with plants that I can grow or forage in the UK and exploring techniques for creating colour for textiles and paper. And so experimenting and developing techniques and then also sharing and teaching and being part of a community where we are making crafts open and accessible to everyone, rather than exclusive elite knowledge base. So for me, it's all about recommoning crafts and then kind of getting nerdy within my own niche of plant dyes and inks and paints and sharing that with other people who are interested in that.
Brilliant. Getting nerdy about a very specific thing is what this podcast is all about.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. It seems to be a lot at the moment of chatting to people on the internet all around the world who are really nerdy about the same thing. We all just sit in our own little cubby holes, beavering away, and then talk about niche, very obscure plants and processes.
That must be really exciting, sort of around the world, because of the different plant types that are native, like plants that you're like, oh, I wish that grew here.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, it's always intriguing hearing about different plants and plants that are very difficult to grow here or hard to find. And then you hear, chat to people in the US and it's like they're like invasive species that they have to go and pull up every year because there's so much of it and they're just growing in the wild and it's just different abundance. Different things that are abundant and then also different kinds of scarcities as well. So
yeah
and also like different approaches, like, you know, I'll share a technique and then someone will go off and push it to the absolute limits in ways I've never even considered and start kind of collecting mollusks from the beach I love that, sharing the process with other people, because then they get interpreters and work within ways that I'd never even imagined were possible.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes on its own journey.
Excellent. I guess, I mean, that's quite exciting because I think of crafts as kind of looking to how things used to be done. And they were all very sort of localized. And if you were making baskets, you were making baskets out of your local material that grew. If you had willow, then you'd be making that. But if it was oak, then you'd be making an oak floor basket. But then this sort of, this globalization and us chatting across the world, we're then introducing different crafts and different techniques to areas where they weren't. So you're getting all this whole new cross-pollination of ideas that's really exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really feel strongly that I see that technology can help us to connect with the land rather than just detaching us from it. And there are ways that we can use technology to come together to learn skills that then can help us to build relationships with our local environment. And when I teach, I like to teach recipes which are where you can interchange the ingredients. So you learn a recipe, but you can go out and find whatever's local to you to to integrate into that recipe rather than just having to buy the ingredient that I use.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because for me, it's not about just, yeah, buying things in packets. It's about, yeah, really learning how to engage with the land again and read the landscape and interact in a practical way, where plants become our things that we work with in our lives and not just pretty things.
And why plants? What is it that draws you to working in this way?
Yeah, I mean, that, God, I think that's, for me, it's not a rational thing. I think it could have been anything. I think there's like approach to craft, which I talk about, which I see you could apply to most crafts, plant-based crafts or any crafts. But for me, I don't know. I think it's, I don't know why I'm drawn to plants. I think they just, when I needed some kind of meaning to life and some kind of feeling of connection, it was the plants that were there that I connected with. And perhaps it's because they can't run away and that they're everywhere. And I love that they are everywhere, but it's like noticing what's there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something in the magic of starting to, yeah, like to, yesterday I went for a walk and I was having a chat with my partner and his mother, and I saw on the ground between us there were all these buckshorn plantain plants just nestled in to the path, and I know that that's one of the most delicious kinds of plantain, and we were all just having a conversation around it, and noticing that and knowing and having that connection relationship with that plant just fills my life with so much richness of connection and belonging. And I mean, it could be, though, you could get the same kind of connection from learning about bird language or learning about earth pigments or learning about the sea or, you know, anything. But for some reason, for me, it's about plants. And that's just, I don't know. I'm just, maybe it's because I'm called Flora. I don't know why, but I love plants.
It's been implanted. Predetermined.
Maybe. I mean, I think I love that, you know, that I can grow them as well. There's something of this growing cycles and the seasons and what you can create within a growing season,
mm-hmm.
and creating a garden. Something that, I mean, there's so much in life, we can be so out of control. I can feel so out of control, but somehow with, you know, creating a garden, wherever I've moved house so much, but I've always been able to create a garden, and that creates that. That's just, there's something kind of deep, maybe therapeutic perhaps, or comforting in that,
mm-hmm.
and being able to do that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was just thinking about, you know, the sort of seasonality of getting colors from things. I hadn't really sort of made that link. I mean, I guess nowadays fashion, it's sort of rapidly changing throughout the whole year, and you've got your autumnal colors and you've got your summer colors, but does that come from the sort of dyes that are available at that time, or is it just that we're trying to pair ourselves with the color of the leaves?
I think there's two different things. There isn't there. I think there is something of wanting to wear the colors that are around us to be blend in with the season. But yeah, I mean, different times of year, I mean, it's like just like foraging for food. I think it's so connected, or herbal medicine. We work with plants in any way. You're wanting to harvest the part of the plant where the energy is at that time of year. So in the, you know, in the summer, it's the flowers and the leaves, and the autumn, it's the roots and the fruits, and the winter, it's the barks. And then in the spring, it's the leaves, and you go round and round in circles. And yeah, there are, you know, I'd say in the autumn, there's more browns and reds and browns and reds and pinks. And in the spring, there's more greens from all the fresh leaves,
mm-hmm.
and yellows. And in the summer, you get all the different colours of all the flowers, purples and pinks and blues. And so there is, yeah, I'd say there is a sort of seasonal cycle to the colours. But I don't think it's so clearly cut and defined.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about sort of the history of dyes. I guess I'm interested in sort of the history and the stories around colour.
Yeah, I mean, I came into natural dyes through an interest in permaculture and foraging. So my interest starts with the plants and with a connecting with the plants, which then moved into the dyes. So I have an interest in the history, but I wouldn't say that I'm an expert in the history of dyes. But I definitely am interested in that. And I'm interested in how our relationship with colours has changed since the advent of synthetic dyes, because before synthetic dyes and paints, when now, obviously, like every colour is available to us, and every colour has equal value. You just buy a set of paints and they're all in their colours, and the only meaning to them is the colour. Whereas in the part with natural colours, whether that's earth pigments or mineral pigments or plant dyes, every colour has its own unique story of where that has come from and the embodied energy, and how different colours have different processes of where they've come from and have different value to them in terms of the amount of energy or scarcity. And so those colours had different meanings in society. And if you're blue or a purple, then that's a sign of high status because those colours were so difficult to achieve. If coming from lapis or from indigo or from mollusks, they're very scarce and energy intensive sources compared to browns and yellows and beige colours that would have been easily created through plants in the hedgerow. And that other dimension to colour, where we're in science in school today, we're just taught about the colour wheel and you learn how to mix colours. But with plant-based colour, it just doesn't work like that. There's chemistry at play with pHs and metals that you work with when making dyes and inks and paints, which means that often if you mix two colours together, you're not going to get a logical colour you'd mix, because it may be that there's a pH shift or there's a metal that's altering the colour. And so there's so much more nuance. I love that in Chinese, traditional Chinese textiles, you often is used as indigo for blue and rhum chinensis, Chinese rhubarb, for yellow. And what I find fascinating is if you dye your fabric blue first with the indigo and then you over dye your fabric with the Chinese rhubarb roots, then you'll get which is yellow, you'll get a green. But if you dye your fabric yellow first with the rhubarb roots and then you dye your fabric blue with the indigo, you'll actually get gold because of the chemical reaction, the dye vat that reacts with the rhubarb root. You get a completely different colour. So there's a kind of mysterious processes that are playing with our ideas of the colour wheel and how colours should blend and mix. And it kind of means, and I love that the complexity of that, because it means that there's no, although you can play, there are general rules. Everything, every interaction is unique, and you just have to get stuck in and try everything out.
Does this mean that the idea of this, the colour wheel, is that quite a modern idea? Because if before we were getting our colour from plants and they were having these interesting reactions.
I'd say no, because I'd say that as I imagine you experience in your work, if you're working with earth pigments, it does work logically because they aren't reactive.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Well, in that case, let's define the different types of sort of pigment, you know, ways of creating colour, I guess.
Well, there's earth pigments, which is basically like clays. And then there's also minerals like metal salts, ochres that give colours. I mean, earth pigments, mostly clays because they're easier to work with, but there are harder rocks with more precious colours that are worked with. I'm not think of any other sources of natural colour that there are.
And then when did synthesising, when did that sort of come in?
That happened in the 1800s, so with the advent of the Industrial Revolution.
And that's you know, become pretty much the prominent thing now, right?
Yeah, that has become dominant, completely dominant. And because in natural processes are so much more, for dyeing particularly and paint making is so much more labour intensive and energy intensive, the synthetic paints and dyes have dominated massively.
Mm-hmm. So, well, first of all, I wanted to say to you that when you used to live in Bristol, did you ever head out to Wick, where there's it's a now nature reserve, but it's got the most beautifully coloured soil. Have you got some there?
This.
Yes, there you go. That's the stuff.
Yeah, I've only really recently started working with earths and ochres. Because I've mostly stuck with plants, but in the past 2 years, I've started working more and more with earths because I'm becoming more drawn to making artist materials, and I've been making crayons and paints, and I've been exploring earths in Devon. And yeah, I was actually given this jar of this pigment, this earth from Wick, by somebody in Bristol. It's an amazing colour,
isn't it?
It's very iron rich.
Yes. So, so what's that? That's what's going on in that little sample there. What's creating that colour?
It's an ochre, which is an iron oxide.
Uh-huh.
And some iron oxides are interesting from a dye perspective because of the iron content, they work as a reactant with the dyes. Because a lot of dyes contain tannins. So oak gall tannin is the most commonly used kind of tannin, but a lot of tree barks and woody plant materials are high in tannins. And tannins have a relationship with iron oxide, where you combine iron oxide with a tannin, you get black. So there are some traditional methods of creating prints and patterns on fabric by printing with a mud printing, with the iron-rich muds, and then you dye your fabric and those areas react with the dye to create blacks. Mm-hmm. And you can do that with ink as well. I paint with a plant-based ink, and then if you paint over the top with an iron oxide, then wherever the two overlap, you'll get blacks emerging. It can be like invisible ink if you're using very pale tannins and very pale iron oxides. Then when they combine, a colour appears that wasn't previously visible.
Fantastic. It's a thing that seems to be all the rage in the sort of green woodworking world at the moment, is ebonizing, they call it. Woods that have high tanning contents, washing over with a sort of iron-rich solution, and then, seeing it turn black in front of your eyes. It's quite a sort of magic thing.
Yeah, it's really satisfying. And I love that when, I work with a plant and I dye some fabric and it's like, just like really pale beige or something. You think, there's nothing here. It's not. And then if you add, let's say, paint on it with iron or something, and suddenly an image emerges. And it's so reactive, though, iron oxide. It can be demoralizing when you get contaminated iron all over. It can get everywhere so easily. I tend to think, I have a perspective, my perspective is, though, that you can get a colour out of any plant if you work with it with iron, because iron will always find the tannins and draw out some kind of colour, even if it's quite a dull colour.
Yeah. That sort of makes it sound like you feel like that's cheating a little bit.
Yeah, well, it's just not so interesting because it's quite... Yeah, I think it... I don't know. Is it cheating? It can be. Sometimes I feel like it's a cop-out. It could be a bit of a cop-out always to... Because you just end up with loads of greys and be like, wow, look at all these colours I've made, but they'd all be grey and black.
Yeah.
But it can be interesting with, let's say, I found with nettles with iron. And sometimes it's surprising you get greens or like more interesting colours.
Yeah.
But I like that, combining the earths with the plants.
And it seems like a wonderful thing, doesn't it? You've got plants that are growing in earth to then, take the plant, make something, a pigment out of it, and then add the earth back in. You're sort of bringing it back to its state of being alive again, the two sort of elements there, maybe. I don't know. Let's talk specifically about dyeing, I guess, for a little bit.
Yeah.
What sort of things can be dyed, and what, is there anything that works particularly well or doesn't? And you looking at what sort of fibers, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I think, well, it's every fiber takes colour differently, and I think it's the key to dyeing is really knowing what you're working with and tuning the process specifically to those materials. And there are, all materials have their own limitations and of sensitivities to certain metals or absorbencies. So the easiest, so obviously you can't, you can only dye with natural dyes, natural materials. You can't dye synthetic fibers. So you can dye wool, silk, cotton, linen, flax, metal, hemp, any kind of natural fibers. You can dye wood. And but there's, and generally I divided the materials into two categories. I have the animal-based fibers, so the wool and silk mostly, and then I have cellulose fibers, so any plant-based fibers, and that that would include wood as well as cotton and linen mostly that I work with. I divide those because, I mean, they're fundamentally different. The protein-based or cellulose-based fibers take the colour differently, and the colour bonds a lot more easily to protein-based fibres. So if you're wanting good results quickly and easily, then I always suggest working with protein-based fibres to start with. There are other things you can use to make the dyes work well on cellulose fibres. So we always use a mordant, which is a bit of jargon, which basically means a fixative. And but it's more than that. A mordant helps the dye to attach onto the fibres. So it comes from the French word, originally Latin word for to bite. And it's to do with the dye bonding and attaching to the fibres. And the most commonly used fixative mordant is aluminium. And aluminium has a particular relationship with pigments, where aluminium will bond and attach to pigment particles. So if I was just to add, let's say, aluminium salt, aluminium sulfate into my dye pot, I would find in the bottom of my dye pot a sediment of dye that would have sunk and kind of just sat on the, sits on the bottom of the dye pot, which wouldn't be very, isn't very useful to me, because what I want is the dye to attach the fibers. So the trick is you use, you treat the fabric with the aluminium, and then you submerge the the fabric in the dye pot, and then the dye attaches to the aluminium, but the aluminium is already bonded with the fibers. So then you get a strong bond where the aluminium is acting as a kind of glue between the dye and the fabric.
Aha.
So there's various different types of aluminium mordant that you use, whether for if you're using a cellulose dye or a protein-based dye, that's slightly different. There's new mordant, natural mordants being developed every year. I hear about a different kind of, I've heard about aluminium lactate and aluminium acetate, aluminium sulfate. There are a lot of different kind of variations of aluminium-based fixatives. I often use Simplicus, which is a completely plant-based source of aluminium, which is a tree that grows in Indonesia, and the leaves contain 3% aluminium. And it's been used as a fixative for thousands of years. And I buy these leaves, these ground up leaves from a workers' cooperative in Indonesia. And I pre-treat my fabric with the extract of the leaves. And that works as an aluminium-based fixative. But you can also use it to extract pigment. So as I mentioned at the start, how I added the aluminium, if you add the aluminium, it sinks the pigment to the bottom. You combine that with an alkali, it will then separate the pigment out of the dye, and you can filter out the pigment, and then essentially you can then grind up the pigment, and you have a powdered pigment that you can use for paint making, for watercolour paint making, or print making. Just gone off on a ramble, I can't remember where I was going.
We're talking about mordants. Is vinegar a mordant?
Yeah, so vinegar is an assist in the way that it helps to draw the colour out. So often I use vinegar for some dyeing techniques to draw the colour out of plant material, but it's not going to help the colour to fix. So tannins are often used as a fixative. You can use oxalic acid from rhubarb leaves. That's another natural fixative. Or I use citric acid.
So I use a natural tannin and acid mordant, or citric acid and tannin, or I use the aluminium-based mordant from the Simplicus leaves, or I use the aluminium sulfate or aluminium acetate, which are more refined mineral-based mordants that, I mean, I love using just natural mordants, but sometimes I do use those refined minerals, because it just makes it easier for more complicated printing processes and print or dyeing cellulose fibers some colors. A really good natural mordant that everyone has in their garden is rhubarb leaves, which are poisonous, but they can work really well for creating soft colors.
So I'm presuming you're not rubbing rhubarb leaves on, you know, a thing you want to color. Are you, what's the process there?
You boil up the rhubarb leaves and then you strain off the leaves, so you end up with the kind of extract, and then you submerge your fabric, simmer your fabric in that solution for an hour.
Uh-huh.
You just have to make sure you don't breathe it in, because it's quite toxic.
Uh-huh. Something so delicious, so toxic.
Yeah, it's full of oxalic acid. Rhubarb, I mean, rhubarb is quite a poisonous plant, really.
Yeah.
I mean, we can eat the stems in the spring, but it's pretty, I see rhubarb as quite a marginal edible plant, really. It's mostly poisonous.
Yeah.
It's curious, our perspective on plants, how we all eat commonly a plant like rhubarb that's pretty poisonous, and then we have so much fear of other plants that aren't nearly as poisonous as rhubarb.
Mm-hmm.
I think often our view of plants is more cultural than actually based on the practical reality of if it's really poisonous or not.
Yeah. So were you saying oxalic acid there was the rhubarb leaves?
Yeah.
So the only time I've come across that is when I've been timber framing, so working with high tannin woods like a chestnut or an oak. When I work the timber with a sort of a tool, usually steel, I get black marks occurring, which is the reaction between the tannins and the steel. I've then used oxalic acid. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Just sort of washing on a solution of it, and that makes the black marks go away.
Mm.
So what's happening there? Because I mean, to me, that was about as magic as it could be. So that seeing the black marks disappear, sort of. Sorry, I'm asking you a question maybe outside of your realm here. But...
No, yeah. I mean, I don't know exactly the chemistry. I'm not a chemist, but I do work with similar processes in terms of using acids to burn away colour. I tend to use citric acid more than oxalic acid.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, often if I'll dye a piece of fabric a colour, and then I'll make a print paste with citric acid combined with some kind of binder, and I'll print or paint onto the fabric, and wherever I paint, it'll burn away the colour, and I'll have a pattern. It's called a discharge dye process.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I use the same methods, but, yeah, with a different kind of acid. But, I mean, that's the thing. Ultimately, it's just we're all working with the same chemistry, aren't we, and the same materials, but for different outcomes.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Mick from the Mick and Pat Show.
That's right, and I'm Pat.
Looking for a podcast that's like catching up with old friends? Well, you're in luck.
We're here to bring you weekly doses of lifestyle commentary, discuss culture and politics, and top it off with the occasional beer and film reviews.
But it's not just about us. We're a community. Our listeners are our kin, and we let you all have a say in what we discuss.
So saddle up and join the conversation at the Mick and Pat Show. You can check out our website or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah. Okay, well, I feel like I've sort of taken you off on a sort of random, maybe a cul-de-sac there. What's the process of, so you've got a few different plants. Is it always that you're sort of boiling up those plants to release the colour? Is there different processes for different plants?
Yes, there's a sort of generic processes that generally work, and then there are outlying plants that have their own unique kind of idiosyncrasies.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a bit like, I see it as a bit like, mostly a bit like making teas, herbal teas. in that you work with the same logic where if you're brewing up some leaves or flowers, you'll be very gentle and just do a little amount of heat. Whereas if you're brewing up roots and barks, then you'll boil them for a while and steep them overnight and give them a lot of heat. And it's the same, really the same kind of approach in extracting most plants into water using heat and just adjusting the heat to the kind of plant material and their sensitivity to heat. With the main exception is indigo, mm-hmm. which is different in that indigo isn't present in any plants, but the precursors for indigo are present in many different plants around the world. And curiously, none of these plants are related to each other. They're all in completely different plant families. And you extract the indigo through a process of steeping the fabric, the leaves in water, and then oxidizing the leaves and adding alkali, and then you can separate the pigment. But it's a pigment which then needs to be processed again in order to make a dye through a vat dyeing process.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the one exception. Everything else tends to work by the same kind of process of extraction. But not all dyes work well with the same mordant. So whenever I'm trying a new plant, I always try it with at least two different kinds of mordant in order to see which work well with that plant. So it's lots of trial and error. And often it's, I'll work with a plant in the spring and it'll give me a certain amount of colour, and then I'll have a client say, oh, I work with that plant, but a different time of year or in a different kind of in a different part of the world. And they would have got, and they will have created a completely different colour. So it can be, so many different varying factors in terms of, say, the pH of your water or the pH of, or the mineral content in the soil where it's growing and the time of year that you harvest it. And if the plant is in leaf or in flower, or there's so many different variables. But ultimately, the process is quite simple.
Uh-huh. I'm sort of picturing, all these different variables, creating this whole spectrum of colours. And then, what we were talking about earlier about how sort of now we sort of globalise these sort of techniques, but yet everything is taking on its own unique individual characteristics and keeping it a very sort of local specific thing. I really think that's wonderful.
Yeah, and the colours of that particular place and the plants that grow in that place. And I think there's something I find wonderful about, I work often with artists who create artwork that's landscape art, artwork that's very much depicting a place, and then when they start to create their paints using the plants that are also in that landscape to paint with. And the people who came in a course with me was doing this year-long study drawing this oak tree, and then she went out and she made the oak galling with the galls from that particular tree, and then there's all these drawings of the tree with the ink made from that tree, and they feel so much more honest in a way to the place and to be of that place rather than just kind of depicting the place but with alien materials.
Mm-hmm.
Just like I imagine if you build a house with materials of that place compared to materials from the other side of the world.
Exactly. Yes, there's all this sort of interconnectedness. Someone I spoke to on the podcast described sort of building with your local materials as just landscape reconfigured. And I feel that's very much the same with what you're describing there. And that I really like that sort of woven connectedness.
Yeah, and that thing as well with, to have to go through the practice of sourcing those materials and creating them, you get to know that place so much more deeply. So it means that whatever you then create from those materials is going to be so much more considerate and connected to that place, just also by, how you have, means you've gone there many more times and looked much more closely at that place, mm-hmm. and interacted with it.
Yeah, it's really honouring the place, isn't it? And the nature involved. And I like that, and I especially like that interacting and you know, getting, you're starting to look much more sort of focused on what's around you. And I feel the same about foraging. Like once you start foraging, you start, when you go for a walk, you look at the world in a different way. You're examining it in a sort of more, you see everything as a potential thing that you could eat and that needs to be found out about. And I imagine it's very similar with what you're doing.
Yeah, well, it's, yeah, absolutely. It's, deeply connected in that way. And I enjoy as well, but it's not, and it doesn't mean you have to be in a pristine, natural environment in order to have interesting results. I used to live in Bristol, and there were loads of, there's a huge abundance of buddleia that grows in kind of industrial estates, which is a fantastic plant to dye with. And there's all loads of brambles, which are really great to dye with. They have really high tannin content. And I found just as much abundance in the urban environment. And it was also become an interesting practice in the urban environment to seek out those kind of places, those little wayside edges that of abundance that are overlooked. And I found that actually also, I think, is something of being in the city. And how, when you're in the countryside, you're constantly surrounded by nature, and it's kind of less important to have to go out foraging because you're just surrounded by nature all the time. But I remember being in the city, how important it was to me to go out and find those old places and find those plants, because that was my medicine to help with my own well-being, as well as me gathering my materials for my work. So it works in both the urban context and as well in the countryside.
Yeah.
And people's got, there's so much diversity in cities with the kind of plants people grow in their gardens and what is available.
There was we first met at the studio, which we very briefly shared. I think you were just moving out as I moved in, but there was a little space out the front of the studio, which I made a cob sculpture with Emma Colville, a very talented sculptor, and we placed it out sort of in, I think it was in September or November, we placed it out on this little space out the front of the studio. And then the following spring, it was just surrounded by these really tall woad plants that apparently were, I think, you'd planted.
Yeah.
And it was so fantastic.
Sorry, your sculpture was hidden by my plants.
No, it was nestled in there. It was beautiful. I got lots of photos of it.
Yeah, those big yellow flowers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was the thing that you planted on purpose to have a sort of material stock, I guess.
Yeah. So, when I was in Bristol, I had a garden, I had a larger dye garden out in Brislington, but because I was running workshops and I like to grow a few plants in that bed out front to be able to show everybody the different plants. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised as well, in that small bed, I was growing a lot of coreopsis in that bed, and I was amazed by even in that small bed. I think it was very sheltered as well. It's very sheltered down in there. It was a real sun trap. And I remember the flowers, I could harvest them all the way through until November. Where here, now I'm out in Devon, I think the plants die back in October, much earlier.
Yeah.
But it was a very productive little patch there.
Yes. I like the idea of, if you've got your garden growing veg, sort of interspersing the plants that are maybe useful for different reasons, so your dyes and your pigments. Seems like a much more holistic approach to growing.
Yeah. I also like to grow herbal medicines, and there's a big overlap between herbs, medicinal herbs, and dye plants. And I think there's something of how it wasn't that long ago that we would have been much more generalists in the way that we lived and the way that we were as craftspeople, and we would have had plants that had many different uses that we would have grown. And now we've become much more specialised. Yeah, I like to consider the plants, well, with dye plants, I like to consider what other uses they have, and particularly dye plants that have medicinal properties, to consider how those properties will affect the cloth and how if you're wearing clothes that are close to your body, how you want those to be clothes that are dyed with plants that are medicinal and good for your skin and have contain insect repellent and rather than toxic chemicals or poisonous plants or considering as much as it's become trendy to consider in food, you know, people think a lot about organic food and where does your food come from, but it's taking a little bit longer to think the same thing around our clothes and to realize and put two and two together that our clothes are also mostly from plants or from animal fibers, just like our food or animals, just like our food is, and to consider that in the same way.
I think what would be a good insect repellent to be dyeing your plant clothes with?
I mean, for lavender is the obvious one for moths, or any kind of aromatic herbs. You could use sage or thyme or oregano. These kind of aromatic plants, antimicrobial, antifungal, would have be beneficial to wear those. But you know, you have to be careful because not all plants are good for you. So ivy leaves are a skin irritant, and you've got to be careful as well with foraging because you have plants like hogweed and giant hogweed that would be really harmful if you started trying to make dyes from them. So it's not all plants are safe.
But. Yeah, that's sort of one of those. It's a sort of common misconception in sort of my work in natural building. It's it's natural, therefore it's safe. Wow, a lot of very poisonous things are natural. It's not a one size fits all statement.
Yeah, exactly. It's complex, and also it's nuanced as well. What is poisonous is often as many things ingredients that are poisonous, but you only need to process them in very simple ways, and then they become safe, very safe to use.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny. I find it curious the way that. No, potatoes, which is one of our staple ingredients that we all eat almost every day, is a very poisonous plant that we all have to make sure we boil in order to make safe. But there are many other native plants or fungi that need similar processing, but they're labelled as deadly poisonous and you must not eat them and touch them.
We need some cultural shift, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I take great pleasure from using those plants and seeing people's horror. It's all right. Trying to break some of those taboos.
Excellent. So I wondered if you could talk us through, what I'm hoping is that we could sort of go through the process of dyeing something, maybe with something that's commonly available to most people that are going to be listening, in the hope that they listen to this and then they're going to go and dye something.
Okay. What about bud deer? That's quite a common one everyone can probably get hold of.
Yep. Okay, let's go for that then.
Okay. Yeah, bud deer is one of my favourite dye plants. It gives a bright yellow colour. And although yellow is the most common colour you can achieve through natural dyeing, a lot of different plants give yellow. I think bud deer is really worthwhile to work with because the bud deer flowers, which you get the colour from, are so abundant. You can harvest them so easily and so quickly from those kind of wayside, forgotten about edges in cities and urban areas. And they're so abundant that you can harvest a good amount and not be neglecting the needs of bees and butterflies. And you don't need a large amount to get a bright colour as well. So, and you'll notice if you start picking the flowers that your hands will start to turn yellow, and it doesn't matter whether they're the pink flowers or the purple flowers or the yellow flowers or the white flowers, they all give this yellow dye.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's quite intriguing that. And if you look at any of the coloured flowers, of the bud deer flowers, they all have a kind of yellow inner. But if you mush up the flowers in your hand, it all turns yellow, and your hand will turn yellow.
Uh-huh.
It's curious, because then you have the opposite thing, where you have St. John's wort, which is a yellow flower, and if you mush it up in your hands, it turns purple. So mysterious.
There's magic going on, isn't there? I love it.
Serious thing. But yeah, so I tend to collect snow, a bucket of buddleia flowers. I mean, when I'm dyeing fabric, I tend to do measure everything by weight. So I tend to do like same weight dye stuff to fabric. But often if I'm just world crafting, if I'm collecting plants, foraging for plants and using fresh plants, then I'll just, I won't bother measuring. I'll just pick a load and just have a go and have a play. I mean, it's only really important to measure if you want to be able to replicate your results. It's, you don't have to always measure things. So you can just collect a bucket of the flowers and then I pour boiling water on them. I use a pan, a stainless steel pan, and I add water and simmer the flowers for an hour. And there's so much colour coming out of them. You can even, if you want to see when you've got all the colour out, you can take out, can strain out your dye pot, take the flowers and put them into fresh water and see if more colour comes out or whether that's it. That's a good way to see whether you've got all the colour out. And you can do that multiple times if more and more colour keeps coming out. And often with buddleia, that's the case.
Yeah.
So it, because of that, it's good when you start extracting to not completely, you know, to just add enough water to submerge your plant material, not to use loads and loads of water, because then if you do multiple extractions, you're not ending up with like multiple loads and loads of buckets of water.
When quick question, when you're saying the flowers, are we talking which part, where do we draw the line of flower? Is it petals? Is it if we get some stem in there?
Yeah, so the buddleia, it has these pendulous flower heads. So I just break off the whole flower head. I just snap it off. I don't bother separating it. I don't think it matters if there's stem or leaf. If you get some stem and leaves in there, it doesn't matter at all. I'm for pragmatic time-saving practices you can easily get. Because it's already so time-consuming and labour-intensive. So
yeah,
I like to just be quite rough with it. And
great. I like that.
You'll get a good colour. Doesn't matter if you've got some leaves in there or bits of stem.
Okay.
Yeah. So when you extract your plant material, and so you, I basically just, the simplest way is just to simmer the flowers in water for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And then you need to prepare your fabric, and yellows work well generally with a aluminium based fixative.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just so many different sources of aluminium based fixative. If you're working with a cotton or a linen, then you want to use an aluminium acetate. And if you're working with a wool or a silk, which is a protein, then you use an aluminium sulfate. And I mean, there's many, if you want to do it, there's many different instructions online for making aluminium mordants, but ultimately you just dissolve 10% to the weight of your fabric. So if you have 100 grams of fabric, you want to weigh out 10 grams of your mordant and then dissolve it in hot water, enough water to put your fabric in,
mm-hmm.
and then submerge your fabric in that water for an hour or overnight. With aluminium acetate, sometimes I soak my fabric in for a week, but at least an hour as would be the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's all sorts of safety. You'd be careful. I mean, so with the aluminium-based mordant, because you're working with a powdered metal salt, you need to be really careful about inhaling the powder or getting it on your hands. So I recommend wearing gloves and a mask when you're handling the powder. So there's definitely safety issues with using the aluminium mordant. That's where I like to use the Simplicus or the natural acetin tannin mordant most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you want to pre-treat your fabric with the mordant, and then you can either take your fabric out and just dry it for use at another time, or you can take your fabric out of the mordant and then just immediately put it into your fabric dye.
So it doesn't have to dry out, the fabric doesn't need to have reached that dry point.
No, there are some processes where it does, but with these mordants, it doesn't matter. You can just go straight into your mordant. And there's, you know, it's kind of one of those things, I think I'm finding it hard to talk it through, because it's one of those things where it can be as complicated or as simple as you want it to be, like in terms of pre-treatment phase, pre-treatment and scouring to remove any pre-treatments you might have in the fabric. And then there's, for cellulose fabric, you can add protein into the fibers to help the fibers take the color better. And then you can mordant and that's sort of pre-soaking. And it can, something can either, there are some dye processes that are only one stage, and there are some dye processes that are like 7 or 8 stages. Mm-hmm. And the more stages you do, often it means you get more likely to get even colors and deeper colors. But I think it's good to start out with quicker, more simple processes, even if you're not going to get as good results, just because I think it's good to start out with something that's not so complicated. So I mean, mordanting is really important, I think, to get bright colours, but it's not essential. You know, you can just toss your fabric in without having mordanted, but you just won't get such deep, vibrant colours.
Okay. So then, I mean, the step that we're, I'm assuming, sort of getting to is that we then just get our fabric and pop it in our, in the bubbler.
Yes. So you take the fabric out of the mordant and you put it in the dye. It's important that your fabric is always wet when you put it in the dye. So if you're putting it straight from the mordant, then great, it's already wet. But if it's been dried, then you must wet it again for a good amount of time, because fabric absorbs water quite unevenly when it's dry. It kind of doesn't just absorb it all at once. It will like slowly take it in from certain points in the fabric, so then you'll get unevenness. But if the fabric's wet, then it just takes the dye evenly.
Uh-huh.
And then you leave your fabric in the dye, simmer your fabric in the dye for an hour, leave it to soak overnight. And then you can take your fabric out and dry it, rinse it and dry it. And you can, you know, we've spoken earlier about iron, and I've spoken about acids and alkalis, and you can, in the dye pot or afterwards, add acids or alkalis or iron oxide to the dye or to the fabric, and that will shift and alter the color. And that, and your fabric, your naturally dyed fabric, will always be sensitive to pH and will always be sensitive to iron at any point. So even if you had your dyed fabric for a year and you wanted to change the color, you could treat it with a modifier to change the color at any stage.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
So it's important to wash your naturally dyed fabrics in pH neutral soap. Otherwise, they're particularly, some dyes are very sensitive, which I'd say aren't particularly good. Means they're not particularly good dyes. So let's say red cabbage is a really fun plant to work with because it's so sensitive to pH. You can get pinks or blues, but it means it's not a very practical plant to use, but an interesting one for trying out and learning about reactants, because it's so reactive to, if you put a little bit of lemon juice in or a little bit of baking soda, then it will change the color.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, I hope that's given people listening a little project to take on.
Yeah, I think the best way to learn is just to have a go.
Yeah, nice. So I've got some sort of color related questions, which sort of probably should have come earlier on, but they're coming now. So, I mean, first of all, what's your favourite colour?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I really like deep, deep greeny blue. That really deep, rich, emeraldy green blue colour.
Yeah. And how would you be making that?
I really like dyeing fabric with yellow onion skins,
mm-hmm.
and then dyeing that fabric with indigo afterwards. And I think it's because it's not, because the yellow onion skins gives a kind of bright orange, which then goes in the indigo, and then it gives this quite complex greeny blue that's really deep and rich.
Nice. Oh, great. I like that. That's my favourite. That's, I mean, whenever I have to paint anything, I always default to a sort of greeny blue. My boat is greeny blue, you know, sort of tealy, sagey, I guess, is the colour. Anyway, now I'm rambling. Are there any really surprising reactions? I mean, I was certainly surprised by the reactions in avocados.
Mm, yeah, avocados are interesting. Yeah, and I mentioned the St. John's wort that is interesting in the way the yellow flowers give a purple dye. One of the surprising reactions I love is dahlia flowers. If you have dark purple dahlia flowers, if you use a aluminium-based fixative, you can get this bright green dye from the purple flowers, and the dye will look purple, but the fabric comes out green from the purple dye.
Wow.
Curious.
That's really interesting. It does seem like there's a lot of, I mean, I think people would have called it magic, but, you know, there's reactions going on that are sort of complicated and wonderful that really make this a sort of interesting and deep topic.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's why I feel I'm so drawn to it, is because it's infinitely complex in terms of infinite combinations of plant and fabric and different kind of fixatives or mordants, and then working, starting to make art materials as well, and how different ways of making crayons or pastels or inks or paints. It's kind of endless play opportunities.
What's the process for the, say, the crayons? I was looking at those on your Instagram, which is just a wonderful like color explosion.
Yeah, it's really, I'm really, maybe it's because, I mean, I love the dyeing process, but it's all, they're all so lengthy and involved, and I'm drawn to creating art materials because of just that immediacy of just drawing a color on a piece of paper.
With
the crayons, I'm making pigments from either earth pigments or making lake pigments, which is when you precipitate a dye into it and create a pigment from a dye. Or some ground up plant materials that work particularly well. And then mixing that with wax to make crayons. It's pretty fairly simple process. The challenge is identifying the pigments, finding the right kind of pigments and creating the pigments and preparing them so that they work well in the crayons.
If people are interested in learning more, I mean, we've obviously just touched the surface, and I think by knowing a little bit, I now know that it's incredibly complicated and there's so many different, you know, variations. So how can people learn more? Is there some sort of good resources for that?
Yeah, so I mean, I run online courses, so I've got various online courses which are all accessible for beginners, but also there are some which give more complicated build. You can build your skills and go into more complicated processes in natural dyeing and printmaking, ink and paint making, and now crayon making. So I can offer some support and guidance in that way. I also have a club of people who've done an online course with me, and we get together online once a month and just chat about, kind of like a study group, and we chat about what we've been up to, and a peer group really to share ideas, because it's so niche, and most of us don't live next door to people who are also nerdy about the subject, so we just get together on the internet and chat about it. There's also loads of great books out there for people who want to learn more. So I always recommend Jenny Dean's book called Wild Colour, which is a great guide if you want to grow dye plants. It has loads of, just goes through it very thoroughly with images of plants, information about the plants, and samples of the colours the plants give. And a lot of those plants are native to the UK or plants that you can grow easily.
I have a copy right here.
You have a copy. Really good. Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, I've lots of colour swatches and
yeah. I'm a bit dyslexic, so I like books with loads of pictures and colours and not too much writing. That's a good one. And then if you want to go a bit deeper, there's a book called The Art and Science of Natural Dyes by Joy Boutrup and Catherine Ellis. And that's quite a bit more technical and goes into the chemistry and has more complex processes for printing and dyeing. Mm-hmm. So that's like level two.
Okay, well, is there anything that we should talk about that I've missed? Oh, I do have a question. So, so I've seen a lot of people dyeing or colouring. So in my world, colouring plaster with turmeric and things like that. Mm. And they're very, very excited. And they go, look at this wonderful wall. And then in an amount of time, it's all faded out.
Yeah.
Is that just because of turmeric or is that because of a lack of... Would a mordant in that process make it sort of stick and stay?
It's a good question. This is like the million-dollar question, isn't it? Because I think it's a really important thing to talk about. And I think natural dyes get a really bad name because of people who don't know what they're doing, putting things out there that look really exciting and then they wash away to nothing.
Yep.
There's lots of plants that get touted as dye plants that I would say aren't actually dye plants, they're stains that fade. But unfortunately, a lot of those are plants that are very accessible to people, so they immediately grab them when they think they want to do some natural dyeing. So turmeric, I'd say, is turmeric is the top of the list in that way. Yeah. It's river's a very vibrant, bright colour, but it's fits in the category of a fugitive dye, which is a dye where you can't fix it. Will fade, it will always fade, and you can't fix the colour. There's nothing you can do to fix the colour. And fruits and vegetables also fit in that category. So beetroot, any kind of berries that you might use, blackberries or elderberries, that they will all fade. And they'll fade to a lovely grey, which has a value unto itself, but it's not going to be the colour that it originally was.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have, on the other end of the spectrum, we have substantive dyes, and these are plants where often mostly plants that are high in tannins that essentially create their own, create and contain their own fixative. So like oak galls or walnut husks, very high in tannins and dark colours without the need of any mordant. But most plants fit in the middle category. Most dye plants fit in the middle category of plants that will only be stable if a mordant is used. And where earth pigments are ancient and are very, very stable, so in your lime render, if you're working with earth pigment, you can be sure that that colour is going to stay and not change. Whereas if you're using a plant dye, it's never going to be 100% stable in the same way.
Yeah.
But there are tried and tested, just like we have vegetables, which are plants that have been bred for thousands of years to be delicious to eat. We also have dye plants that have been bred for thousands of years to give vibrant and stable colours for dyeing. So like madder root, which is Rubia tinctoria, that's a plant that's been bred mostly in Asia and then more recently in Europe to give a strong and vibrant red colour. And that's going to be a lot more effective and be a lot more light fast than its native relative, which would be lady's bedstraw or wild madder that grows on the coast, that will only ever give you a very pale pink that will fade a lot more quickly. So I think if you're looking for bright and vibrant dye plants, to use the plants that have been traditionally used and bred for dyeing before when that was our only source of fabric colorants.
Mm-hmm.
So like weld and madder, indigo, dyer's marigold, dyer's chamomile. And often the plants that are good for dyeing contain the words tinctoria or tinctorum in the Latin name, or they'll contain like rubia, or they'll contain Latin words for colour and that implies that those plants have been used historically for dyeing, and they stood the test of time. And because there's a lot of kind of faddy plants that people use that they're not really proper dye plants, but also it depends on what you want to do. Because I often make crayons with turmeric because it's so quick and easy and they're so effective. And you know, sometimes if you're just want to do a quick little drawing, it doesn't matter if it's not permanent. I think it's all about the intention of what you want to do and whether it needs to be permanent or not. In some cultures, it's normal to re-dye clothes and to not expect them to last forever. And I think this idea and expectation for permanence is partly a product of our culture and not something to be a slave to, but to be kind of pragmatic and think about, does this need to be permanent or does it not need to be permanent? And why does it need to be permanent? Why do I need to make it last forever? We live in a natural world that doesn't, where everything's always changing. So why are we trying to create permanence?
Mm-hmm.
I'm more interested in asking those questions than to personally and having those conversations than about trying to make everything permanent.
Yeah. Great. I mean, that's the parallels between that and the sort of building world are pretty strong. You know, there's great buildings in North Africa which are all made of mud, and every year they have a big festival where the whole sort of village will turn out, and you know, it's a big event to replaster this building, and it's actually a sort of celebrated thing that it's a renewed process, a yearly process. I think finding those reasons for sort of ceremony and tradition are like wonderful things that should be encouraged and not sort of bred out of our society.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it, nail on the head. And there's something of as well that culture of repairing and fixing and taking care of, rather than expecting something to just be so resilient that it just takes care of itself indefinitely.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ah, thank you so much to Flora. That was so great. And the parallels between building the way that I think we should be building and what she's talking about, there's just so many, and it fits so perfectly. Do head to plantsandcolour.co.uk or Plants and Colour on Instagram. That is the UK spelling of colour, so COLOUR for our North American friends. Yes, the details, she's got online courses. You can go and do courses in pretty much everything that we've discussed, all sorts of stuff. Really good website, so check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes. What else to tell you? Oh yes, I have a spoon carving course coming up, my first one in over a year, so I'm really looking forward to that, looking forward to teaching a few more people the ways of wood carving. That is at Winterbourne Barn in Bristol, and it's on the 22nd of May. You can book through their website, which is winterbournebarn.org.uk. Yeah, and as when I was looking on their events page, the very next course they're running is on the 26th of June, the day before my birthday, and is about natural dyes with Rhiannon Hall. So maybe you can get along to that. Okay, that's it. Subscribe if this is your first time. Make sure you check out other episodes. Do please get in touch. I've had a lot of people sending in emails. They're really always wonderful to hear. But yeah, so thoughts, comments, questions and concerns, get them in. I think that's it. I hope you're all very, very well.
and looking forward to the world opening up a little bit more over the next coming months. That's it. Bye-bye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.